With the state of today's economy, it is more important than ever to invest in products that last for years to come. As the seasons shift and get cooler, make sure your closet is stocked with durable layers that stand the test of time from American Giant. American Giant's clothes work harder and are wearable season after season. Their greatest hoodie ever made is made of the highest quality materials that are cut and sewn right here in the United States. So you're investing right back into your local community. Choosing American Giant means taking a stand for American manufacturing and hardworking Americans, something other mega corporations don't care about. From fleece to knit, all in a range of colors for versatile daily wear, American Giant delivers everyday pieces designed for everyday life. Feel the difference of quality made-to-last clothes from American Giant. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from TRE, Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain and around the world. For more information, please visit tre.radio.
The TRE Book Show is sponsored by audible.co.uk. Download one title each month, plus unlimited listening to thousands of Audible originals, podcasts, and audiobooks. Just click on the Audible banner at www.tre.radio.
The Book Program, presented by Hannah Murray.
Good evening. Welcome to tonight's book show. I'll be starting off by looking at the bestseller lists on Amazon.co.uk and the Sunday Times, the oldest and most influential book sales chart in the UK, and seeing what new entries there are. There's quite a few this week. Then we'll be chatting to Kate Galley, whose inspiration would often come from the many varied lives of her clients as a mobile hairdresser. Her debut novel, The Second Chance Holiday Club, is described as funny, later life uplit. Catching up with Ian Brown. He's a writer and producer for television and former Fleet Street journalist. His TV credits include Top Gear and This Is Your Life, and he's worked with everyone from Pierce Brosnan and Harrison Ford to Simon Cowell and Tom Jones. His latest Albert the Tortoise book is out now. It's called Albert in the Air, and he's launched a new series called Hug and Bug about a messy yeti and a mountain flea. The first book is Finding Home. Also with us on the book show is David Tabatsky. He's authored, co-authored and edited many novels, including The Boy Behind the Door, Friends Like These and The Marijuana Project. The Education of Ryan Coleman is the first book in a new series called Filthy Rich Lawyers. It's a satirical legal thriller filled with scenarios loosely based on real-world interactions. And that's just the first hour. In the second hour, we'll be hearing from Lynn B. Holton, Rebecca Reed, Tina Pritchard, and Owen B. Lewis. That's tonight's book show on Talk Radio Europe.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Depends in my hand.
Welcome to tonight's book show. I'm going to start off by having a look at the Sunday Times bestseller list, the oldest and most influential book sales chart in the UK, and the one that every author wants to be on. The chart is the most accurate and comprehensive estimation of book sales in the country. So looking at this week's bestsellers, after months, if not over a year, of stagnation in the fiction charts, it's all changed this week with new novels from Janice Hallett, Bret Easton Ellis and more. Only last year's most popular names, that's Colleen Hoover, Richard Osman and Bonnie Garmus, have stuck around on the list. Prince Harry's memoir, Spare, was always going to be biggest on its first week, but although it's far from last week's glories of 467,185 sales, this week's 82,540 copies is still hugely impressive. So starting with fiction hardbacks, there are seven new entries from last week. A new entry at number one, it's called Godkiller by Hannah Kaner. A god-killing warrior and three unlikely heroes face a reckoning. A new entry at two called Really Good, Actually, by Monica Heisey. A 29-year-old woman embraces her new status as a divorcee. At number three, a new entry called Emily Wilde's Encyclopedia of Fairies by Heather Fawcett. A curmudgeonly professor studying fairy lore finds love in a small village. At four, It Starts With Us by Colleen Hoover. At five, Lessons in Chemistry by Bonnie Garmus. Number six, The Bullet That Missed by Richard Osman. And all the rest are new entries. Number seven, The Mysterious Case of the Alpert and Angels by Janice Hallett. Rival authors probe the notorious case of a delusional cult. Number eight is The Shards by Bret Easton Ellis. A serial killer draws ever closer to a group of privileged high school friends in Los Angeles. Number nine is The Cloisters by Katie Hayes. An intern finds a mysterious deck of tarot cards at a Gothic museum. And number 10 is The English Führer by Rory Clements. A former spy is brought out of retirement to uncover a deadly plot. Moving on to general hardbacks, not a massive amount of change there, just two new entries from last week. At number one, It's Still Spare by Prince Harry. Number two, The Boy, the Mole, the Fox and the Horse by Charlie Mackesy. Number three, Why Has Nobody Told Me This Before by Julie Smith. Number four is a new entry, The Creative Act by Rick Rubin, the American record producer's wisdom on artistry and the creative process. Number five, The Boy, the Mole, the Fox and the Horse, the animated story by Charlie Mackesy. Number six, Menopausing by Davina McCall and Naomi Potter. Number seven is Food for Life by Tim Spector. Number eight, Elizabeth, an Intimate Portrait by Giles Brandreth. Number nine is a new entry called The Story of Art Without Men by Katie Hessel, an illustrated revisionist history of art with women front and centre. And number 10 is Manifest by Roxy Nafusi. So that is the Sunday Times. Moving on to Amazon.co.uk, which as always is a mixture of fiction and non-fiction. The 10 best-selling books of this past week. Number one, Bored of Lunch, the Healthy Slow Cooker book by Nathan Anthony. Number two is Spare by Prince Harry, the Duke of Sussex. Number three, Bored of Lunch, the Healthy Air Fryer book by Nathan Anthony. Number four, Atomic Habits, the life-changing million copy number one bestseller by James Clear. Number five, It Ends With Us by Colleen Hoover. Number six, Pinch of Nom, Enjoy by Kay Allinson. Number seven, 8 Rules of Love, a new guide on how to find lasting love and enjoy healthy relationships. That's by Jay Shetty. Number eight, Why Has Nobody Told Me This Before by Dr. Julie Smith. Number nine, What's for Dinner? Fuss-Free Family Food in 30 Minutes by Sarah Rossi. And number 10 is the new one by Jojo Moyes, Someone Else's Shoes.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Thank you for listening to Talk Radio Europe.
You're listening to The Book Club on Talk Radio Europe. And keep listening. That's an instruction from Margaret Thatcher.
Joining us on the line now is Kate Galley. She gets a lot of her inspiration from the many varied lives of her clients as a mobile hairdresser. She's with us on the book show to talk about her debut novel. It's called The Second Chance Holiday Club. It's described as funny, later life uplit. Welcome to the book show, Kate.
Hi, Hannah. It's lovely to talk to you.
Oh, it's lovely to have you. And congratulations on your first novel. Very exciting.
Thank you. Yes, indeed. Very, very exciting.
Oh, has it been a long time in the making?
No, I mean, it hasn't actually, to be fair. You do hear some stories of, you know, people writing for many, many years. It sort of feels like a long time, but really I started writing probably in 2017, just for fun, just to give it a try. So really, that's not a great length of time. And I started writing this book during the first lockdown. So again, that's not a, you know, on the great scheme of things, that's not a huge length of time. I haven't got an axe to grind of a long journey in the writing world.
Oh, fantastic. So you did well getting an agent and a publisher then?
Very well, yeah. It was a mentorship scheme that it started out. So my agent sort of saw the first 20,000 words and obviously saw some merit and sort of took a chance, which was fantastic. So I was able to work with him to sort of get it into good shape before it went out to publishers, which was fantastic.
Yeah, great stuff. So Uplit, I'm not sure I've heard of Uplit before. What is that?
I mean, it's basically, it means uplifting literature. And I suppose something with a happy ending, I guess. I did read somewhere, I think it was in The Guardian, they had quite a good, and of course I'll have forgotten the quote now, quite a good quote, something along the lines of everyday heroism and an appetite for love, but not necessarily romantic love, with a sort of a happy ending. And I think that pretty much encapsulates it, I would say.
Yeah, nice. So was it obvious for you that those were the kind of books you wanted to write?
Not really. I started trying to write a sort of a darker mystery, I suppose a thriller. But I just wasn't really hitting the right beats and it just wasn't working. So I had a conversation with one of my, I'm a mobile hairdresser, I think you said, and I had a conversation with one of my clients between Christmas and New Year 2019, and she'd been on a Christmas coach trip. And it was a complete disaster. And I was doing her hair and she was telling me about it. And it was a disaster, but she was laughing about what had happened. And basically by the end of having finished her hair, I just sort of said, well, that would be a great short story. And I went away and started writing it. And that's what happened. So I sort of ditched the thriller idea that wasn't working and turned to something entirely different. Mm-hmm. I must say that the lady whose hair I was doing, this is not a story about her. It was just one little thing that happened to her during her Christmas coach trip that I've included in this book. And it was, I would say it's inspiration, but the characters are absolutely fictitious.
Yeah. You must meet some amazingly interesting people doing your job and hear some fantastic stories as well.
I definitely do. They are hugely inspirational, actually. And not that I would ever write about anybody directly, but just little snippets of stories of people. Somebody was telling me about a lifelong promise. So a divorced couple who divorced amicably, and this is many, 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 many years ago. And they didn't have a family, but he had promised, even though he'd married to somebody else and had moved to America, he had promised that if she died first, that he would always make sure her wishes to have her ashes scattered in a certain location happened. And he did. He flew over with his wife and made sure that happened. And I just think that's such a lovely tale, basically.
Yeah.
So things like that all the time, really interesting people, and especially the older generation, which is who I tend to write about now. And they have, you know, they really do have amazing stories because I suppose they've been on the planet for a long time and have lived a life.
Yeah. Isn't it interesting how people tend to open up to hairdressers as well? Like, it's a known thing, isn't it, that hairdressers or nail technicians end up hearing all kinds of stories and secrets some of the time as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I literally hear lots of very personal, very emotional personal stories that people want to tell me. And I guess it's someone that is, you're intimately involved with in a way, and yet completely detached from. So once that person has left, I mean, I'll do their hair and I will leave. And then I'm probably not thought about, as it were, you know, between times. But then when I'm back there again, it's right, you know, really need to tell you about this. It's a sort of a personal relationship. It's a strange one, I suppose.
Yeah. But a lovely one. I mean, it must be lovely for people to have that kind of trust in you and want to talk to you about things. I mean, I guess not everyone is, but you could get really awkward situations where people kind of don't want to say anything. I mean, some people want to relax when having a treatment as well, don't they? So I suppose not everybody's chatty.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And you can definitely be guided by the person that you're visiting. But I suppose for me, because some of my clients, I've been doing their hair for sort of 30 years. And so they're as much friends as they are clients. And I think also because I'm a mobile hairdresser, so I do go into people's homes, people tend to, I guess, want to chat because they're in their comfortable, familiar environment. Mm. Less so perhaps in a salon, if you think people are listening. So you're less likely to perhaps to chat in that sort of situation. But no, I suppose it's inviting somebody into their home, it tends to, you know, sort of kick off a conversation straight away, I would say.
Yeah, definitely. So tell us about the lead character in the Second Chance Holiday Club.
Okay, so we have Evelyn Pringle. She's a sheltered septuagenarian. She's 76. And she has lived a long and loveless marriage. She's really quite desperately unhappy. And her husband, Tony, is found dead in his car on the hard shoulder of the M3. And he's wearing his best suit and with a diamond ring in the pocket that would never fit her. And Evelyn wants answers. And she finds him in a letter hidden amongst his possessions. And it's in part a love letter to another woman, but it's also a confession to something that Tony has done. So completely out of character, Evelyn packs a bag and books herself onto the Christmas coach trip to the Isle of Wight. And her intention is to find the woman and hand deliver the letter. So she's completely out of her comfort zone and meets Cynthia and Joy on the trip, two women who, to start with, she doesn't really want anything to do with. She doesn't really want anything to do with anybody. But Cynthia is quite a bold character. She's sort of a driving force type character. And unwittingly, Evelyn finds herself sort of thrown into their path and they sort of join forces, if you like, and become friends. So the hotel actually is a complete shambles. And Cynthia is very much a sort of, right, no, we're not going to complain. We're going to make the best of it. And they sort of unravel each other's predicaments. And as I say, they sort of become great friends, which is the sort of the uplifting element of the story.
Mm. It's interesting, isn't it? In that kind of time of life, I guess, it's so wonderful and inspirational to think that people can start a new life, you know, whether it's starting a new relationship, moving to a new country, just traveling, you know, doing so. It doesn't, obviously, health permitting, your life isn't over because you get older or because you retire. There's still so much that you can do. And it's wonderful to see people embracing that.
Absolutely. And I think for Evelyn particularly, she's sort of carrying a baggage of grief around with her. And it's this friendship that with Cynthia and Joy that really, you know, helps her to unpack that, if you like, and that makes it so she's able to move on, something she never would have considered. So it really is a sort of a chance encounter, and her intentions are not admirable or particularly nice in sort of trying to find this particular woman and hand deliver this sort of ticking time bomb letter. But actually it sort of propels her into these, you know, these women's path. And this friendship is something that propels her onto the next, you know, next part of her life that she didn't think would ever be possible and would never happen. Mm. So it really is, like you say, it's never too late. You can always, you know, turn back the clock, if you like, and do something different.
Yeah. Gosh, it's a whirlwind of emotions there. She must be going through this, Evelyn, losing her husband, but at the same time finding out that he was obviously in love with another woman and not being able to get those answers from him because he's died.
Absolutely.
It's heartbreaking.
Yeah, and that is it, isn't it? It's that sort of the one person that, well, not that he ever was honest, but the one person that you could ask and hope to be honest is sort of no longer there. So it's sort of a really a blind sort of walk into the dark to find out the answers herself. So, but it's not, she doesn't find, it's not what she expects, let's say. So it's sort of, it's a different, it's different to how she would have imagined it would have gone, I suppose.
Yeah. Oh, don't say any more. I'm intrigued.
No, I wrote. It's so tempting, isn't it?
Yes.
So tempting.
Yes. So did you enjoy the writing of the book?
I honestly love the idea of getting the idea down, the excitement of creating the characters and all of that. And then I love starting to write it. Everything's fresh and exciting. And then about halfway through, there is that honest sort of, oh, this is rubbish. You know, what am I doing? Why am I doing this? But I'm writing my second book now. Or I'm editing my second book now. So I know the rules, as it were. I know that there will be that sort of middle part where you think it's all terrible and why are you bothering? And then you see the end result and it's all worth it. But it's just, sometimes it's just a slog to get to the end result.
Yeah.
But it's definitely worth it in the end. But it's not the easiest of processes. But I think as long as you know that there will be times that it's tricky and you just have to push through. You absolutely have to push through to get to the end.
So do you feel that you've learnt quite a lot from the experience of writing your first book that you've been able to implement or not implement into the second book?
Definitely. I thought, and that was the problem, I think, when I started writing the thriller back, you know, in 2017, and I hadn't planned it properly. A lot is talked about whether you sort of plan or pants your way through a novel, but I didn't really have, you've got to have at least have a basic structure in place, because otherwise you're just writing into a void. And I certainly have learnt that I sort of started doing that a little bit again with the Second Chance Holiday Club. And then I reminded myself to stop, to think and to plan properly. And that really did make a massive difference for me, for sure. And so I've taken that thought process into writing the second book. I still find myself completely surprised at certain points. So as much as I plan, there will always be surprises. Things will happen that you don't expect your characters to do certain things. And even though it's all coming from your own head and you're making it up, they can certainly surprise you, which is interesting.
So with the second book, is it a whole new bunch of characters, or do some of them carry on from the first book?
No, totally different. It's another uplifting tale as such, with the older generation again. And it's my main protagonist is called Connie Fitzgerald, and she's approaching her 70th birthday. And after a lifetime of leading a sort of an untethered and nomadic life of travelling in a camper van and working on the go, she's finding herself newly engaged and a soon-to-be grandmother, and she's beginning to think it's time to settle down. But there's a chance encounter that throws open a window to her past, and she decides to head to the Highlands, actually, to find an old friend. So it's a road trip book, and I love a road trip. So I'm totally in my comfort zone with this one.
Oh, fantastic. Well, if listeners want to get a copy of the first book, it's called The Second Chance Holiday Club. It's by Kate Galley, who we've been chatting with today. And the book is available on our website, tre.radio. Kate, thank you so much for joining us and good luck with it all.
Oh, thank you so much, Hannah. It's been brilliant.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray. The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us back on the line on The Book Show is Ian Brown. He's a London-based writer and producer for television and former Fleet Street journalist. His TV credits include Top Gear and This Is Your Life. He's written or produced for the likes of Pierce Brosnan, Harrison Ford, Simon Cowell, George Lucas, Martin Scorsese, the list goes on. He's back with us in The Book Show to talk about book four in the Albert the Tortoise series. It's called Albert in the Air. He's also started a new series with Owen Clark as the illustrator called Hug and Bug. And Finding Home is the first one in the series, which is out now. And we've got book two, The Comb, coming out in a few months' time. Welcome to The Book Show, Ian.
Thank you, Hannah. What a lovely introduction. I might say thank you and good night there.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, it sounds like you've been busy.
Well, we have, certainly, I have to say. And it's very, very nice to be in this position. I mean, when we first spoke nearly 2 years ago, who would have thought? It's all very tentative and we weren't very sure how people would take to Albert the Tortoise and such like. But here we are, as you say, book four, Albert in the Air, out now. And all still based on the real family pet tortoise, real Albert, who, of course, is hunkered down now. He won't be waking up for some months yet. He's hibernating. Missing out on all this action, but it's an absolute thrill.
Does he have any idea how famous he is now?
Well, you know, every spring and summer he gets a good idea because the camera is sort of in front of him a lot. We have to sort of secure pictures while he's sort of up and about. And, we sort of get him posing with the books and any other stuff that's going on. So I think he has a little idea, probably.
So how long does he go into hibernation for? It's a really weird thing to imagine, having a pet and not kind of seeing them and feeding them for a few months at a time.
Well, amazingly, it's about 5 months.
Wow.
And I hasten to add, that is a sort of an old-fashioned way of doing it. But Albert is more than 80 years old, could be 100, we just don't know. And we don't change his routine. He's done that with our family more than 50 years, nearly 60 years now. And I think the worst thing you can do for them or with them is change a routine. And so, you know, whereas if you've got a new tortoise now, they would also sell you, you know, like a special tank and heat lamps to keep them warm through the winter and keep them awake for longer. Albert lets us know about the end of October, he sort of winds completely down, slows right down, and is ready for bed. And then usually we start checking on him much more regularly, sort of mid-March, and then in theory, sort of end of March, beginning of April, he'll be up and back with us.
Wow, that's amazing. So throughout that time, he doesn't eat, no?
No, he doesn't. It's a great weight loss plan. I don't recommend it for humans, obviously. But, absolutely. And I explain that now to children when I go into schools and libraries and bookshops and such like and read all the stories. And they're astounded. You know, he sort of eats and eats and eats through the summer, obviously, grass and bits of cucumber and salad and such like. Dandelions he loves, which is featured in the first book, Albert Upside Down. And he really has to gain weight. You know, we have to weigh him actually quite regularly, make sure he's putting on the weight, and then he's ready, you know, to go down and not eat or drink for all that period. He's absolutely down.
Amazing. Really is. I mean, like you say, you have to explain it to kids. I'm an adult and I'm learning a lot each time we chat. So Albert in the Air is book four, is that right?
Absolutely, yes. And once again, as I say, based on real Albert, as with all the other stories, Upside Down, he really does every now and then go upside down in the garden, ends up on his shell, and we sort of rush over and generally put him the right way around. But I got to thinking, well, what if all the little creatures in the garden, you know, had to come to his rescue? And that was the start of that one. Albert and the Wind, as I said, he eats salad and bulks up through the summer. But on a windy day, if he doesn't eat quickly enough, his salad blows away. And so I got to thinking, well, what if all the other little animals, you know, rounded that up and he had to say thank you? And then Albert's supersize is absolutely about his hibernation, because scientists have done a study and they now think that tortoises dream while they're hibernating, because although they're sort of almost in a state of stasis and absolutely shut down, their brains are still really busy. So they now think tortoises dream. So I thought, well, crikey, 5 months sleep, you're going to have a supersized dream about your cousins, the dinosaurs. So that's that. Albert in the Air, when he was a young tortoise, much younger, about 40 odd years ago, Albert used to dig out of the garden all the time. They're really good at digging, little claws, and they really, really go for it. And he used to dig out under the fence. And so in Albert in the Air, he digs under the fence and goes on a big adventure outside the garden and ends up sort of tangled in some balloons and even goes flying. There's a flying Albert in the story.
Brilliant. But I hope he gets home safe.
Well, that would be a spoiler. Spoiler alert. But okay, let's just say things end okay, Hannah. Good. Don't fret none.
Sorry. Good, good, good.
That's okay. Don't worry.
So tell us a bit about this new series then, Hug and Bug.
Well, I'm very, very excited. To say, you know, I've sort of persevered to try and make these books happen, decades to become a published author. You know, very sweetly, you mentioned all sorts of things in your introduction, and I've been a very, very lucky chap. I know that. I had a very, you know, good career, TV career, and I'm, you know, as I say, very, very blessed to have had that. But all that while, I was trying to be published. I was trying all sorts of different things, novels, other children's books, chapter books, other picture books. And then, luckily, the Albert sort of idea came to me about 5 years ago when he did go upside down in the garden. But jump back now 50 years, dare I say, to some school homework, a school project, where we were given the title to write anything we wanted about the Himalayan flea.
sounds riveting.
Many, many times, submitted all over the place, agents, publishers, all over. And fortunately, because the Albert, the Tortoise books, are doing okay, Hannah, the lovely publishers, Graphic, said, have you got anything else? Mm. And lo and behold, I sort of pulled out Hug and Bug, which is how it's ended up. It's a rhyming story, and a bit different to Albert the Tortoise. This is a rhyming story about a messy yeti in the Himalayas and a mountain flea who doesn't like the cold. And so the flea is looking for somewhere warm to shelter, and he tries all sorts of things, an old boot, a sock, a cave full of bats, a yak, some goats, all sorts of places, and ends up in the fur of the yeti, and they sort of team up, and the flea keeps the yeti tidy and the yeti keeps the flea warm. And I'm thrilled to say it's once again the start of a series. Graphic are very, very keen, and book two, The Comb, will be out on March 24th. Owen and I are working together again on this, and it's very, very exciting.
Amazing. All inspired by a bit of schoolwork.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, 50 years of rewriting it, literally. I would revisit it, have another go at it, and it changed so many times, you know, in how it was presented, the characters' names and what it looked like and such like, what happened. And then it just sort of, it seemed to make sense to end up as a rhyming book. So you've got that sort of dum-de-dum-de-dum pattern to it, of the hopping flea, really. That was the idea of it. And luckily, I'm now reading that in schools as well, and the children rather like it. You know, he's sort of, obviously he's an abominable snowman, but in the book he can't say that properly, so he calls himself a bummy nubble snowman, and the kids rather like that. And I've even, you know, I'm now taking them to schools a sort of a furry yeti, as well as my sort of wooden tortoise to talk about Albert, and I also have an inflatable dinosaur now, Hannah, to talk about, you know, his links to the dinosaurs and such like. It's all very exciting. I'm covered in props when I arrive places now, and everyone goes, oh, what's all this about? But it's very, very nice indeed to be doing it.
I hope you're not taking in actual fleas, though.
I hope not. But of course, as we all know, certainly most of the children in our life have had encounters with fleas, so I think we're all fairly well versed in them. And that was the other thing about it, really. I just thought, well, children know all about fleas, they just get them. And you know, it just seemed a thing that made sense to me, that children might like it. And fortunately, they seem to be taking to Hug and Bug as well as they've taken to Albert the Tortoise.
Oh, that's great. So children are warming to a flea character, are they?
They are. Very cleverly, illustrator Owen Clark, clever chap that he is, he's made the flea quite cute, actually, I have to say. He's not sort of scary or anything, but he's fairly anatomically correct, I have to say. You know, right number of legs, and he's got the sort of the shell-like body and such like, but he is quite cute as characters go. And, of course, the yeti is, I think, wonderful. He's designed an incredible-looking yeti, and, people are indeed taking to it, and all being well, there will be four books in the Hug and Bug series, but number two is on the way. And, you know, very, very exciting. And as you say, keeps us very busy indeed.
Yeah. So will there be more in the Albert series, or are you finished with the Albert series?
Well, dare I say, will be if people can bear it, and I hope they can. Yes, Graphic, the publishers, have asked for another four. So we've already prepared a book five of Albert, and that will be coming in June this year, where he encounters a pond, Hannah, and all sorts of new animals enter his world thanks to this sort of watery new thing in the garden. And then we're also working on one that may involve the shed in the garden. And then there will be another two after that next year, 2024, all being well. But we're, you know, we're sort of on the way with them, tinkering away here and there with artwork and ideas. And it's just thrilling, absolutely thrilling. And it's also thrilling, you know, obviously, to still be reading the ones that are with us. You know, the first four, I'm still out there reading them, talking about Real Albert and such like. And it's very, very exciting indeed. I'm just enthused by it still, luckily. And, you know, as long as people want to hear me talking about Albert and reading the stories, I will keep on doing it.
Yeah, wonderful stuff. And when you launched Finding Home last October, a copy went to the Himalayas.
It did. You know, absolutely sort of amazing timing and how things come together. I started working, or I got, was contacted, I should say, by a lovely charity called Bookmark Reading, who put... well, books into schools that are struggling to afford them, and also they place volunteers into schools to help children with their reading skills and reading confidence. And very kindly, Graphic agreed to gift 100 of Owen and my books to Bookmark Reading, and so they've now been distributed to schools all over the country. But at that time, they were also organising a sponsored trek to the Himalayas. And I thought, well, crikey, what timing. Hug and Bug, set in the Himalayas. You know, is there any chance they might sneak a copy into a rucksack or something and take it there? And, you know, who knows? And they totally agreed. They were totally on board. They took a copy to Everest Base Camp. So something like 34,000 feet or something could be the highest ever book launch. I don't know. I don't think any such thing is recorded in the Guinness Book of Records. But it was absolutely thrilling. And the photos that came back were wonderful. You know, sort of Hug and Bug, the cover sort of all in the sunlight. And there is Mount Everest in the background.
Oh,
absolutely incredible.
Fantastic.
And they did a wonderful job, raised quite a lot of money for Bookmark Reading. And if people want to look them up, they're a great, great charity that do some lovely work, you know, sort of helping children to read. Their goal is that every child should read, really, and I'm totally on board with that.
Definitely. Oh, that's fantastic. Well, it's lovely to catch up with you, as always, Ian. Thank you so much for joining us. If listeners want to get book four in the Albert the Tortoise series, it's called Albert in the Air, then there's the new Hug and Bug series, book one, out now, called Finding Home, with book two coming out shortly called The Comb. Ian Brown, thank you so much for joining us, and give my love to Albert.
I would indeed. Thank you very much indeed, Hannah.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now is David Tabaski. He has authored, co-authored and edited many novels, including The Boy Behind the Door, Friends Like These and The Marijuana Project. His memoir, American Misfit, was published in 2017. He's with us on the book show to talk about book one in a new series called Filthy Rich Lawyers. The first book is called The Education of Ryan Coleman, and it's a satirical legal thriller filled with scenarios loosely based on real-world interactions. Welcome to the book show.
Yeah, I'm here.
Thanks for joining us. You're the co-author of this book, is that right?
I am the co-author of Filthy Rich Lawyers, yes.
And yes. How did the series and the collaboration come about then?
Well, Brian Felgoise, my co-author, came to me a few years earlier than that, maybe a couple years earlier, and he had met me through... someone else in Philadelphia who I had done a book for. And so he approached me about doing a nonfiction book on the class action experience he has had as a young lawyer and for, you know, 25 years or so as a practicing lawyer in that field. And he had been involved back in the early 2000s, you know, around the Halliburton case with the former vice president, Dick Cheney, who was the head of Halliburton. and Enron and other big name things like that. He wasn't the primary lawyer on any of them or even on the primary team, but he was sort of in a auxiliary ring of lawyers, because in these huge class actions, there are maybe even sometimes dozens working on a case, but then you have only the small handful of big sort of star name lawyers who are the ones who get all the media attention, whose names are actually on the suits, you know, that are filing. So Brian had all this experience in that. The problem was, I mean, we ended up, I wrote a book proposal and there was some pretty nice response to it. But overall, we realized that, you know, that the Halliburton thing and Dick Cheney, that had come and gone, and there had already been other books about it. Brian was not one of those quote unquote famous lawyers, like I said. So we didn't find, through this, our agent didn't find, you know, the right publisher. So then Brian said, gee, I really want to do this story, is so cool, I think, but wait, what if we did it like in fiction? And I thought, oh, wow, that's a kind of a fun twist. That would be more fun for me, even, that's for sure. Because I had been working on a lot of heavy subjects in several books I'd done over a few years with, you know, books related to cancer and parenting and divorce and domestic violence and, you know, some really heavy, you know, mental health subjects also. And so this was a real relief for me just to go into an open universe to write a book loosely based on somebody's experience, but to create a satire. That's where I brought Brian along to a different approach, to treat it more like a satire and have some fun with it. Otherwise, how entertaining might it be? Right. So I had a lot of fun doing that. That's really how the whole thing kind of came to be.
And with regards to the writing process, how did you work out who did what? How were you able to write these together?
Well, writing is a multi-layered process. There's creating the storyline, right? What this happened, and then this will happen, and then that'll happen, and then when this happens, you know, it creates a chain of five other events, and then you have to make sure that through the book they make sense, or you don't give things away too quick. And so there's a lot of plotting and twisting and turning and strategizing some of that stuff. And then there's the actual craft of banging it out and really bringing it to life and then editing it. So Brian and I worked together on the outline, and we had a quite a strong, specific outline. When I started to really get into the nitty gritty of writings, you know, kind of scene by scene, chapter by chapter kind of thing. And so it was a lot of back and forth in that way.
But it works well. You make a good team.
It was actually, for me, the one who I was, you know, Brian's the lawyer, I'm the writer kind of thing. It was a good balance, because he had a certain way of approaching work and approaching a project, you know, whether it's a book or it's a lawsuit or doesn't matter. There's different, you know, there's still a way to approach something. And so that was all very easygoing. And yeah. There were like little, you know, there are always little bumps along the way. But they're so temporary. They're even just within a conversation. Like, no, he shouldn't do that. What if he does that? Then this is going to happen, or that happens. Wait, what about doing it this way? No, I don't know about that. You know, like, you know, those kinds of, you know, all that kind of stuff. Yeah. Oh, that's not funny. Yeah, it's funny. You know? there's that. Yeah.
So tell us about the character of Ryan Coleman then.
So Ryan is the main character. He narrates the book, and he's loosely, and I say that word largely, he's very loosely based on Brian's life. Brian was a young lawyer when he started out, he got this, he was sort of in an auxiliary position on this class action suit. And he had to go down from Philadelphia, where he lived and practiced law. He had to go down to Dallas, Texas, to a federal courthouse down there. And being like a young, brash, very well-dressed, snappy guy from Philly, like the real Northeast, hyper, you know, ambitious, you know, who like full of himself thing, but also inexperienced, he kind of stepped in it with the judge in the courtroom. And that's how the book opens, with a scene that's really the only one that's actually based on a real experience Brian had, but in mushrooms from there. But he was, you know, a young, ambitious lawyer, and he did get, you know, in over his head for a little bit there in Dallas, got chewed out pretty good by the judge, but he ended up getting his share of money. And he met a guy we call in the book Robert Smalley, but it's based loosely also based on one of these hot shot, you know, big time, very powerful lawyers, guys who are making tens of millions or more of money. And, you know, living large, let's just say, and very arrogant. Mm. And it's sort of, so it turns into somehow a kind of a satire on these young or middle-aged, you know, masters of the universe. So it's a lot about male behavior and male wealth. And there is one woman who's in that veritable boys club, Eugenia Cawley, but she uses the nickname Jean because she likes the ambiguity, the gender ambiguity of Jean Cawley, the name, or people don't know. They kind of assume it's a man. His name is Jean, you know, but then when they meet in person, she's a tall, imposing woman. But she's learned to play like really wicked hardball to rise to where she is in that fraternity of male lawyers.
Mm. So will Ryan remain the main character? Are we kind of following his journey through the book?
Yeah, it's his journey because he ends up on this road where there's definitely some forks in the road where he has to choose, and that how does his burgeoning, exploding career conflict with his own personal code of ethics. And this continues throughout book one, and it goes even deeper in book two, which is coming out in April. Book one came out October 2022, and then I think it's April 20th, something like, give or take a day or two, that the second book is coming out this year. And that's a continuation. A literal continuation of what happens and how book one ends. It picks up right there in book two.
And have you already decided how many there's going to be in the series, or are you just going to one at a time?
Yeah, kind of one at a time. Oh, well, two at a time. We did the first two. I wrote the second one pretty close, right after the first one was done. It didn't wait very long, which was also good because the momentum was there and the plot line was very fresh in my mind and Brian, and we were, you know, we had outlined book two, but by the time book one was finished, it had changed and kind of, it didn't follow it exactly. And you can't really do that once your energy kind of goes on a daily basis, writing new ideas come, or it's almost as if the character says, I don't want to do that. Let's go this way. It's more fun.
Yeah.
You know, there'll be more possibilities. I don't know what they are, but there's more doors open if you go left here instead of right. You know, it's like the character's almost, you know, telling you, or you have that hunch. You don't really know. It's a lot of it's following hunches.
Mm. And what about the setting? Is it set in present day?
Yeah. It's a few years earlier. It's before COVID.
Okay. Yeah.
But it goes pretty much. That's an actually an interesting question, because what will happen at the end of book two when we go into book three? Will it? What will the time frame be? Will we go up? Will we go as far as COVID or not? And I'm, because once you include COVID, it would change everything, how to write it, you know, yeah. And what the storyline would be. Because you know, especially in those early days, if it's going to go up into 2020, it's right now, I think it's basically 2018, 2019. So the next obvious thing would be, does it go into 2020 or does it all kind of stop and happen in a shorter period of time? Because, man, once you go into COVID, it's going to dictate so much.
Mm, absolutely.
You can't really pretend it didn't happen.
No, no.
Then it's science fiction.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, if people want to get a copy of the first book in the Filthy Rich Lawyers series, it's called The Education of Ryan Coleman. It's available on our website, tre.radio, and it's by David Tabaski and Brian Felgoise. It's David who we've been chatting with today. David, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Hannah. I really appreciate it. So, yeah, or you could go also, if they want to know a little bit more, they could go on the website, filthyrichlawyers.com. And they can find out, you know, just to read if they want to know a little bit more about the plot line or see a few pictures and know anything more about me or Brian.
Perfect.
The
Book Program, presented by Hannah Murray.
TRE.
Talk Radio Europe. The Book Program. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Good evening. Welcome to the second hour of tonight's book show. We've already spoken with Kate Galley, Ian Brown, and David Tabatsky. In this hour, we'll be chatting to Lynn B. Halton. She won the 2013 UK Festival of Romance Innovation in Romantic Fiction Award. She freely admits she's an eternal romantic and writes feel-good, uplifting novels about life, love, and relationships. Her latest is Finding Happiness at Penvenon Cove. It's the third book in the series set in Penvenon Cove in Cornwall. Also joined by Rebecca Reed. She's the author of the novels Perfect Liars, Truth Hurts and Two Wrongs. She's a freelance journalist and columnist for the Telegraph Women's section. She's the former digital editor of Grazia magazine. Her latest novel, The Will, is about one family and eight letters. Will they get what they deserve? Also joining us is Tina Pritchard. Her first book, a psychological thriller in Deep Dark Wood, was published in 2021. Her latest novel, The Sea Glass Beach, started life as a short story, morphing over the years into a novel. It's a work of fiction inspired in part by her mother's experience of giving birth to a child at Sean Ross Abbey Mother and Baby Home in 1950s Ireland. And finally on tonight's book show is Owen B. Lewis. He was a support worker for adults with learning difficulties and mental health issues. It was there where he gained inspiration for Vulnerable Voices. It's a coming-of-age novel for young adults. And that is tonight's book show on Talk Radio Europe.
The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Pens in my hand, ending unplanned, staring at the blank page before you. Open up the dirty window, let the sun illuminate the words that you could not find. Reaching for something in the distance, so close you can almost taste it. Release your inhibitions, feel the rain. Live your life with arms wide open. Today is where you're
Joining us on the line now is Lynn B. Holton. She won the 2013 UK Festival of Romance Innovation in Romantic Fiction Award. She freely admits that she's an eternal romantic and writes feel-good, uplifting novels about life, love and relationships. Her latest novel is book three in the Penvenon Cove series. It's called Finding Happiness at Penvenon Cove. Welcome to the book show, Lynn.
Hi, Hannah. It's lovely to be here. So lovely to be here, actually.
Oh, it's great to have you with us. When did you start writing? How long have you been writing for now?
I started writing at the end of March in 2009. And I've had a couple of very diverse careers first before I was able to sort of set everything aside and actually sit down and have the luxury of writing. Although I'd sort of started writing when I was about 11. So I was sort of very prolific. Writing all sorts of things, particularly poetry and short stories between 11 and 15. And then I met my husband when I was 17. We married when I was 18. We had our first son at the age of 18 and then our second son 5 years later. So it's sort of like, for me, it was writing had to go on hold. And basically, I just kept a journal with ideas, one-liners. When I sit down to write a book, I just have a one-liner and that inspires the whole story. So I ended up with this massive journal with loads of one-liners. And in late 2008, I'm sort of like, I have a very intuitive psychic nature.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of 2008, I just sensed that my mum wasn't well, and she didn't say anything, but I could just sort of tell. And everyone around me was saying, no, she's fine, she's fine. Anyway, I gave up work at the end of 2008 and said to my husband, I just need to take a few months off and spend some time with mum. And he was fine with that because I just changed careers. I mean, I'd only 2 years before that changed careers. I'd gone from a 20 plus years career in finance to a career, a very sort of bizarre, in interior design. And that was my hobby. I've been doing that as a hobby for friends for a long time. Anyway, I got this opportunity and it was my dream job. And I had this feeling that I had to spend more time with my mum because obviously it was a very energetic job and long days and that sort of thing. You just get to see your parents at weekends. And my father at that time had died a couple of years before and she was on her own. So I had this feeling. Anyway, I gave up work at the end of 2008. And by the start of March, she fell, had a really nasty fall, broke her hip and an arm. Ended up coming to live with us. And unfortunately, she had a heart attack and died at the end of March. So it all happened very quickly. And it was awful because I sort of knew it was coming and it was hard to deal with it, you know. But I'm not really a very natural nurse. And I tried to get it through, sort of get her through it as best she could. But we had some real laughs. And that last month was just sort of wonderful, really. So when she sort of, after she passed, it was such a shock. I mean, just coming to terms with it was horrendous because she was the rock of our family and my husband was equally as devastated, as were our sons. And, you know, my husband said to me, do you know what? Don't rush back to work. We've got to go through probate. You've got to sort of things out. That's going to be traumatic. Why don't you sit down and write? Now, I'd written a novel. I'd sat down about 3 years before that and written a novel because while I'd wanted to write all my life, I didn't, you know, until you sit down and write a novel, you don't know if you can write like 80 or 90 or 100,000 words. You just don't know. So I sat down and started writing in between doing probate, sorting out things, which was extremely tough. And I wrote five manuscripts back to back. And then I sat back and I thought, right, what do you do with them once you've got a manuscript? And that was where it started, really. Wow. So, yeah, so I've been starting since the end of March 2009.
Amazing. And,
I think I'm on my 29th book at the moment. So,
wow,
yeah,
it's fantastic. So you feel like you've found your calling?
Oh, most definitely. And in a way, really, as my husband said at the time, it's what your mum would have wanted you to do. And it's a bit difficult because you have a career, your husband has a career, you know, have a lifestyle, and all of a sudden you're saying, right, okay, I'm going back to nothing. You know, I'm just going to be writing. I don't know if I'll ever make a career out of it. I don't even know if I can do it, you know. And he just said, no, it's what you need right now to get you through this, you know. And And he was so right. And, you know, I haven't looked back. And now I regard writing as my sort of quality time. You know, unless I'm with the kids, that's my utmost priority. The rest of my life is spent writing, because when I'm writing, I'm just in a totally different space, you know, and it's wonderful. You know, it's certainly got me through the last couple of years anyway.
Yeah. And did you always know you wanted to write romance?
No, I was very much into sort of historical fiction, and I was a sort of a great sort of follower of sort of things that happened in the 1800s, and you know, sort of discovering new territories and that sort of thing. But then I read widely, because I was also reading Stephen King, you know, at an age when I shouldn't, because it scared me to death. Hmm. But it was actually really sort of, you know, I shouldn't have been reading it at that age, you know. But it was, it opened my mind. But when I sat down to write, you've got to remember, so like my mum had just died. And of course, the first page of my first novel was, you know, the first thing this the main character sees is they see the light, you know. And but it's a fun, it ended up being a fun take on it, and there's a big twist in it. So it isn't really about death, and it isn't a downer. But the funny thing was, when my mum came to stay with us, we owned an old hunting lodge then, and we had a little cottage in the garden that had been converted, and it had a bedroom, a bathroom, and a sitting room. And that's where I nursed mum. So I'd sleep on the pull-out bed in the sitting room so I could be with her all night, and we'd talk during the night and that sort of thing. And I'd write out there, but I could only write until dusk, because the side light would flicker constantly. And I knew it was mum there with me, but it just felt, you know, a little bit crazy, you know. So, it was a bit strange, really. But, I always knew I was going to write, but it was just sort of sitting down and actually finding the time to do it. And I was so grateful for that, because I knew it would make her happy. And it certainly got me through that awful phase, you know. Mm-hmm. And it took a long time. It was for all of us. It took a long, I mean, even with my husband, it was probably 6 months until we could have a car journey and put the music on. It was that sort of devastating. Yeah. You know, she was our rock.
Yeah, I understand. So tell us about this series then, and the setting of the series.
Well, Cornwall has always been very dear to me, because it takes me back to my childhood memories, holidays there. So, and as an adult, it actually became the place I go when I want to unwind and be one with nature. I mean, and the funny thing is, I mean, I prefer going to Cornwall in the winter. And I know that's a bit strange, but because it's beautiful in sunshine. But, oh my gosh, Cornwall in the winter when the storms are, it's absolutely something else. I mean, it's so evocative, it's so emotional, you know. It really is. It's one of those places that sort of stirs you up, you know. And I was a great lover of the Poldark series, obviously. I think a lot of people are. Mm-hmm. And it just, you can just imagine the history that's gone on there. And when I was actually asked to sort of write a Cornish series, and I thought, you know what, this is just what I've been waiting for. And I mean, we've been so many times, and we still go, you know, if we can, a couple of times a year. But when I'm doing research, it's a totally different sort of visit, if you like. It's because whatever country I'm writing about, I always have to visit. I have to go there. I take about 200 or 300 photos, so that when I actually sit down and write the book, I've got everything I need. With Cornwall, it wasn't quite the same in terms of, I know it so well anyway. But I wanted the right setting, and I didn't want it to be a sort of a fictional setting that was too far away from the reality. And I think a part of the premise for me was very much that I've lived in two very off the beaten track locations myself. So we've lived down near the Severn, the River Severn, in a little village called Arlingham, and that gave me my first insight into what it's like to be snowed in winter and flooded in you know, in the rains and that sort of thing. So that was quite good. And we also lived in a little village called Huntingford, which was literally about sort of like half a dozen houses in Gloucestershire. So it's sort of, I wanted to sort of bring all of that into the Cornish feel. We've got quite a few friends down in Cornwall, and as I say, go quite often. So I sort of already sort of knew where I was going to set it. But I think, you know, we were wandering around Charlestown when my husband and I went down to do this sort of like the initial research. And I could just imagine the fictional Penvenan Cove nestled very close by. So literally it would be next to sort of Charlestown. And then sort of, you know, tapping into sort of what it's like with the local community and that sort of thing. And also the problems that are very specific to small communities, you know, particularly in Cornwall, it's, you know, you've got a lot of people sort of with holiday homes and that sort of thing. And it is a real issue, you know, and it affects the local community, you know, if the balance isn't right. So I sort of, you know, when I sat down, I only had my one liner, which was Kara Shaw, who was a young entrepreneur. Well, she's 30 now, with a big heart. But she always felt like an outsider growing up in Cornwall because she was the IT geek on the edge of her little sort of posse or little group of friends. She was the one sort of looking in, and she lost her heart to a young guy called Ross Treloar, but she could never tell him. And she was always sort of like watching him and what he was doing and really interested. But when she moved away, she suddenly moved to London and she came into her own. She set up a website, a social sort of media type website, and she ended up sort of 8 years later, nearly 9 years, selling it for sort of like a massive amount of money. So she goes back home because her mother dies and her father's trying to keep her mother's dream alive, which they had a kennels for sort of dogs and that sort of thing. But it was never his dream because he was a carpenter and he's making a hash of it. The dogs aren't sleeping in the kennels. They're actually sleeping in the house. And she goes back, you know, she goes back while her mum is poorly until the very end. But when she goes back a few months later, having sort of sold her business and tied up her loose ends, she's like, "Dad, the house smells of dog. You can't keep them in the house. They need to be in the kennels." You know, so for her, it's very much going back to sort of help him. But when she gets back there, she sees that basically the local community is sort of going downhill. Everything is old. Everything needs an injection of cash. And as a serial entrepreneur, she can't help herself. So immediately she's in there. "Oh, I could tie this person up with that person. We could get something to help and this sort of thing." But of course, in a very small community, every single thing you do, if particularly as you come back into it, having been a bit of a square peg in a round hole in the first place, is scrutinized. And of course, she links back up with Ross because he does an extension on the back of her grandmother's cottage, which she moves into. Everything gets blown out of proportion. So it becomes an epic thing, her return, which was supposed to be just slide in gently. You know, I don't need to earn money. I can just be low key. No, it ends up sort of, being on the tip of everyone's tongue. Like,
is it the location that stays the same in the books, or have you got the same characters coming through?
It's both, actually, although they can all be read as sort of standalone stories. Because I don't give the sort of full backstory, but you can sort of end up reading, if you read the first one first, which is sort of, you know, the one that wraps up the series, you can still read the others as prequels, if you like, standalone prequels. So you've got Coming Home to Penvenan Cove was the first one, Making Waves at Penvenan Cove was the second one, and then Finding Happiness at Penvenan Cove was the third one. But it's very much the same characters, although new characters come in, obviously, and it doesn't just deal with the two main characters. I tend not to write in that way. It's very much, and particularly for the series, it's all about the community, the central communal characters, because they all sort of, there's a lot of interaction and a lot of newcomers come in, but they're newcomers that come in with the sort of ethos that this isn't my holiday home. This is where I want to live. This is the sort of life I want. And if I can help the community in any way, I will, you know, and it's that supportive structure. And I think if the last few years have taught us anything, it's that we need each other, we need people.
Absolutely. You know? So is this the final book in the series?
It is in this series, but there is a new Cornish series coming. Okay. Which is about to come out on the 11th of May, which is set in a cornhouse, a Cornish farmhouse. And there's a manor house attached to it. And again, it's very community orientated, but a slightly different slant because it's sort of like not right sort of on the beach as the cove is. It's a bit further back inland. I mean, from a totally different sort of point of view, really, because it's about a young woman who has just gone through a divorce and is having to make herself fall out of love with her husband. So, oh, sorry, that's my Bengal cat's just woken up. Let me just open the door a little bit. Don, Lizzie, sorry about that.
Okay.
Yeah, so she's just having to start her life again. And whereas with the Penvenon Cove series, it's very much about Kara going back home, knowing that she never fitted in the first place, knowing that the person that she gave her heart to, she can never tell him that she gave her heart to him because he married while she was away. And it's just her fears, really, about whether if she goes home, she actually finds that it's not the right thing for her and then she'll have to go away again. If she goes away again, she's made her success. What does she do next?
Mm. You know, people will have to read on to find out.
That's right.
If people want to get a copy of the book, it's called Finding Happiness at Penvenon Cove. It's available on our website, tre.radio, and it's by Lynn B. Holton, who we've been chatting with today. Lynn, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you to all the listeners for listening in.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Hello, little Alan Bennett here. If I'm not writing books, then the thing I like most is listening to the book club on Talk Radio Europe. Fancy.
Joining us on the line is Rebecca Reed. She's the author of the novels Perfect Liars, Truth Hurts and Two Wrongs and the non-fiction book The Power of Rude. She's a freelance journalist and columnist for The Telegraph's women's section and a regular contributor to Telegraph Culture. She's the former digital editor of Grazia magazine and she's with us on the book show to talk about her latest novel, The Will. Welcome to the book show, Rebecca.
Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for joining us. So how does writing books compare to writing articles and working on magazines?
I mean, it's a really good question. I suppose I was in the digital journalism era where you were expected to write sort of 8 pieces a day of about 500 words each. So I think novels are slower and perhaps more thought through, whereas I was very much, you know, pushing out as many pieces as possible in any day. And then, of course, with journalism, it's very research-led. It's very much about, you know, the story, very much about usually somebody else's voice. Whereas with novels, you know, it's all on you and you get to make it all up. But I quite like that because the research aspect is not my favourite part of journalism, getting bogged down in details.
Yeah. So do you feel like you have more freedom with writing novels then?
I mean, of all the things I do, I think writing fiction is my absolute favourite because there is that total freedom. And I suppose with journalism, you have to let the story go where it needs to go in terms of the facts. Whereas with writing, I find that I sort of start and I let it take over in and of itself, which is a, you know, a really wonderful experience.
But I suppose all the journalism and getting used to writing and writing to a deadline and things like that has all helped with the novel writing.
Absolutely. It's incredible training. I feel very fortunate to have been able to do both. And yeah, as I say, the speed thing is great. And also, I suppose that sense that the most important thing is that you sit down and you move your fingers against the keypad and you get words on the page. And, you know, when it's your day job, you don't have a choice, which sort of helped me. I think some people struggle to get the words down because they're worried about being perfect or it being right. Whereas I kind of, you know, with me, I'm used to the idea that you have to write something, even if it's not perfect.
Yeah. So when you were writing for magazines, were you thinking for quite a while, oh, I'd really like to become a novelist? Was it kind of a dream for a while or did you make it happen quite quickly?
It was quite quick. So I did an MA in creative writing when I was about 22 or 23. And as a result of that, I got an agent pretty much as soon as I finished the MA. And then I wrote a book just after I signed with that agent, which didn't sell. And that was obviously fairly crushing because, you know, it's 85,000 words of work and I was pleased with it, but nobody wanted to publish it. Mm. And then I was, but actually it was the best thing ever because it in retrospect, it wasn't a brilliant book. And also it taught me how to write a book. And I think a lot of the time you have to accept the first one you write might not be the first one that hits the shelves. Mm. So yeah, the novels happened pretty concurrently to journalism, really. I got my first book deal in 2017. So I was a couple of years post MA, and I was kind of building both at the same time, really. I mean, to be candid, my attitude towards writing was always, this is such a gift of a job, I'll do any kind of writing anybody will pay me to do.
So did you know from the start the kind of books that you wanted to write, the sort of the genre that you wanted to write in?
I think I did. I mean, it was very much that kind of Gone Girl, Gillian Flynn, you know, that sort of era where thrillers were really popular. So my first one, I suppose I really wanted to write about female friendship and about girls and womanhood and more just to kind of have these toxic friendships, which is what Perfect Lies is about. So the thriller aspect is more of a vehicle to write about the relationships that I wanted to write about. I'm not one of those novelists who can, you know, write a sort of 300 word novel just about people talking to each other. I kind of need something to tag all of my observations to. So the thriller comes in more as a structure, I suppose, than the main aspect of the novel.
Mm. So looking at the new book, The Will, there is friendships and things that come into it, but it's more about family, isn't it?
Yeah, this one is. So the premise of The Will is that there's this huge old stately home, and generation to generation is inherited in completion, so you get everything, but it's not sort of primogeniture where the first oldest child gets it. So they pick somebody to inherit the house based on who they regard as sort of most worthy, which causes huge tension within the family. And they are a family who love each other, but like a lot of families, they're very complicated, and there are a lot of sort of, you know, secrets, manipulations, old family histories that people are aware of. It's just as there are with any family, really, but perhaps more complicated when you add into the mix lots of money and privilege and wealth.
It's a shame, isn't it? It's such a horrible thing that can happen when somebody dies, and obviously there is money or possessions at stake, and the idea that family members turn against each other because of wanting to get the inheritance. It's awful. It's such a terrible thing to happen, but we see it happening, don't we?
It's extraordinary how even, you know, families who you think are pretty rock solid can fall apart over money fights. But I think the difficulty is when everybody is grieving, you know, grief makes you behave erratically and unpredictably. So if everybody in the same room is grieving, everybody is behaving out of character. And that's when things really start to fall apart.
Mm. So how many have we got in this family?
Oh, that's a really good question. Four, five, six, nine living.
Okay.
And then
wow.
The matriarch, Cecily, is dead.
Yeah. So are they all very kind of different characters? Are there any alliances there, or are they all out for themselves?
Yeah. So it's Grant and David and Elspeth are the children of Cecily. So they're in their 50s and 60s. And then their children are there, Jonty, Willa, and Lizzie, who are in their 20s and early 30s. And then there are various people's respective partners. And I liked writing, you know, people's boyfriends or girlfriends into it so that you had that outside perspective, because I think we've all had that experience where you go and stay with someone's family and they, you know, to them, their family is completely normal, and to anybody, to an outsider, they're extraordinarily eccentric and utterly bizarre.
Mm. Must have been great fun writing all the different characters for this.
It was. I love it. And I think when I start writing, I always feel really daunted by the size of the project and the word count. So I find that writing from multiple perspectives is very liberating, because you're not trying to write 100,000 words as one person. You're trying to write, a lot of smaller, shorter stories. Mm. So I would say if anybody is interested in writing, it's a really good place to start to kind of use multi-perspectives.
Yeah.
And also it's great because it means you can stray all over the house and you can hear different sides of the same conversation. And you have a sort of choose your own adventure type sort of vibe when you have so many different characters you can follow.
And have you done something like that before from so many different perspectives, or was this a new thing for you?
I think they're all from various different perspectives. And I usually jump around. I like to jump back and forth in time. I love, you know, every sort of third or fourth chapter to be set somewhere else. And in this one, it's got different snapshots from throughout the past. There are scenes from the 90s, the 70s, from the 60s, 50s. And it's lovely because I get to write, it's a little bit of a historical writing experience for me. And also I like that sense that you know, the house is a constant, but you get an awareness of what's happened there in the past and who's been there and who's lived there and what and how in every generation it reinvents itself.
Mm. So tell us about this house. What's it like and whereabouts is it?
So it's called Roxburgh Hall and it's in Norfolk, though, to be fair, I'm not sure you get much of a sense of Norfolk itself because it's all very much inside the house. They're all sort of quite locked in. It's high summer. It's beautiful 17th century house. There are lots of family rumours about who built it and why. And everybody's lost sight of the truth. But basically it's huge and it's also... Unlike most British people, it's not freezing cold and a little bit dirty, as most stately homes are. You know, it's actually well insulated and kept clean, and it's still a very enjoyable place to live. Which I think anybody who's gone round a national trust place would realise they're usually pretty chilly.
Yeah. So why did you make it like that?
I think I like enormous houses, and I like how they sit in a community, and how they facilitate families sort of staying together in a different way. You know, most of us who live in a 3-bedroom house have to move out eventually and can't keep coming back to stay all the time because there isn't space. Whereas when you've got an enormous house like that, the family keeps getting together again and again and again, and it fosters a sort of codependency. And also, I suppose, more gossip and more drama because they're spending most of the summers together, all of bank holidays, all of Christmas and things like that. So those relationships continue to change and develop. But also, I think we all know that you get stuck in patterns with people you've known since childhood.
Yeah. And do you know what your kind of inspiration was for this story? Was there a particular moment or a particular person that you inspired this?
So I have no idea if it's true, but there is a rumour that when one of my grandparents died, when everybody was at that, you know, when everybody sort of converges when someone's dying, apparently some papers went missing. And I don't know whether it's true and I doubt they were important, but everybody got fixated on it because I think when you're in the midst of grief, you sometimes need somewhere to put your energy or something to focus on. And I think that's where it ended up being with my family. And this is many years ago, and I think everyone's over it now. But I like the idea that you could have a group of people together who are mourning, but whose mourning is derailed by an obsession about trying to work out what's happened and why it's happened.
Mm, great stuff. Well, if people want to get a copy of The Will, it's available now. It's on our website, tre.radio, and it's by Rebecca Reed, who we've been chatting with. Rebecca, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray. The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line is Tina Pritchard. Her first book, a psychological thriller in a deep, dark wood, was published in 2021. Her new novel, The Sea Glass Beach, started life as a short story, morphing over the years into a novel. It's a work of fiction inspired in part by her own mother's experience of giving birth to a child at Sea Ross Abbey mother and baby home in 1950s Ireland. Welcome to the book show, Tina.
Thank you very much for having me, Hannah.
Oh, it's great to have you with us. And yes, an amazing story to tell. Can you tell us a bit more about the background regarding your mother?
Yes. Well, as much as I know, because in actual fact, my mother really didn't want to talk too much about her experiences of being in Shaun Ross Abbey, which is a mother and baby home, as you said. But yes, it was going to be that I was going to be adopted from the home, but there was a change of heart or a change of mind, and in actual fact, I went home with my mother and lived with my grandmother for a period of time whilst my mother went over to England to work. And then she sent for me, and she remarried, and I grew up as an army child.
Wow.
But, she didn't really talk too much about it. So the book is definitely a labour of love. And although it's a work of fiction, some of the events described are inspired by my own story and that of my mother.
Mm.
So the themes really are coming of age, loss, love, death, religion, sexuality. They're all in the book.
Wow. Yes, a lot going on there. And it was a terrible situation. It was a big deal, wasn't it, that happened in the 1950s in Ireland, if women were unmarried. Was that was the issue, wasn't it?
I think it was. There was a lot of stigma. I mean, not just in the 50s, well into later years, the stigma stuck both for the mother and for the child, which in part is why I've actually dedicated the book to the mothers and children who became part of the adoption scandal. I don't know whether you're aware of it, but there's been a big investigation into it, and reparations are currently in hand to offer some compensation for mums and babies who were placed in these places.
Gosh, that's happening now.
Yeah. Wow. That's happening now. So it's quite interesting to follow, really.
Yeah, definitely. So are you involved in that, what's happening now?
Well, the problem is, I actually went home, so I wasn't adopted. It's really for children who were adopted.
And have you been in it for research for the book and everything? Have you been in touch with people?
Well, obviously, my own experience, I've brought into it as much as I can, and I have looked at what's going on. But the reparation being offered as well just is being offered to children who were mothers and children who were there for over 6 months. So if you were there for less, and I was only there for I think about 3 months. So I have there's actually a picture in the back of the book of me and my pram when I returned home, and I would be about 3 or 4 months old, I believe. So I was actually at home, obviously, and didn't stay that long in Sean Ross Abbey.
So have you been back since? I mean, is it still there?
It is. It's in a bit of a state of disrepair, and I think there are plans to do something with it. I haven't quite. But every year there is actually a reunion of mums and babies. I don't know whether you remember the Philomena story.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah. So Philomena, who I believe is still alive, she returns with her daughter to celebrate, I suppose, the lives of those who passed through the portals of Sean Ross Abbey. So, but I haven't been back, no. I actually moved, as I say, I came over to England when I was about 3, and my grandmother obviously lived in Ireland, and I went to visit, so I went backwards and forwards during school holidays and for various periods during my life. But sadly now, she is obviously deceased, so I don't go back to Ireland. And I don't know, examining my feelings, I have been on holiday to Ireland and enjoyed it, but I'm not sure that I'm ready to go back to that and examine it too much. But I have examined it and researched it at a distance.
Yeah, no, fair enough. So tell us about the single mother in the book, Teresa.
Yes, I mean, Teresa, maybe loosely based around my mother, and again there's a picture of my mother in the back of the book, and I think you probably might see some sort of resemblance there. Teresa's quite bright, and she finds herself in this situation, ends up going into the mother and baby home to give birth with the intention of her child being adopted, but she changes her mind and brings her daughter home and raises the child as a single mother, which would have been a very incredibly difficult thing to do in Ireland during that time. But she does it quite successfully, and Teresa's bright, and she puts her, uses her resources, her both physical and mental, to good use, and does a really good job of bringing up this child, who actually is a little bit of a bit problematic in a way. She's gifted. Roisin is the child that she gives birth to. She's gifted. She's intuitive. She's very in touch with nature and, the natural world. But viewed by the local community as a bit odd, a bit high-spirited. She's got this thing, she loves to run barefoot, so, any opportunity she kicks off her shoes and runs barefoot, very much at one with nature. And obviously this pits her up against the local community and the church and school. And as she's moving towards adulthood, Teresa then becomes increasingly fearful for her daughter's future.
Mm.
So, she has to come up with some sort of solution to, dealing with this situation because she doesn't know what's going to happen.
So how old does Roisin get in the book?
She's 16.
Okay.
In the book.
So is there there's a certain amount of time set when she's a baby and when she's born, yeah, and then it jumps to 16?
Yes. Yeah, so
okay.
Teresa makes the decision, heartbreaking decision, following a visit to the convent school that Roisin attends. In fact, I don't know whether that's a bit of a spoiler, but they're talking about expelling her from the school, and Teresa makes a momentous decision to protect her daughter and decide she's got to send her away.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's sort of the first part of the book, and then we have Roisin is actually sent away on a boat to Canada to live with her aunt and uncle, Aunt Peggy and Uncle Joe, in Nova Scotia in Canada.
Okay, so away from Teresa.
Away from her mother, and at that time, you probably would be thinking, I'm not going to see my mother, and Teresa would be thinking, I'm not going to see my daughter again. You know, it's expensive to travel, and it's a long, long way away, so the idea of actually seeing each other again, so it's a pretty heartbreaking decision for Teresa to make, and obviously devastating for her child, Roisin.
Where does the title come from, The Sea Glass Beach?
Right, it's quite significant in the book, so sea glass is actually, it's actually glass that has been placed in the sea. It's undergone a transformation by the action of the waves and the sand. I think it stands as a metaphor for something that emerges stronger and a thing of beauty. But it's quite significant because when Roisin is actually in Canada, she meets Cal, who is a neighbour. He lives on the neighbouring farm. And Cal, one Christmas, makes her this beautiful, I suppose, mobile, really, with sea glass on a driftwood base. And she's very intrigued by this, and he takes her to this beach where sea glass is regularly washed up.
Mm.
And she's absolutely entranced by this. And as I say, it's a bit of a metaphor for transformation.
Great.
That's going on. Mm-hmm. Essentially, the book is rite of passage, I suppose, for Roisin.
And has it been quite kind of cathartic for you as well to write up a little bit about your experiences and your mother's experiences?
I think this book was hovering around at the back of my consciousness for a long time. I'd actually written things down and got little bits of paper and little conversations and things and put it together as a short story, as I mentioned. And somehow it was bigger than a short story. It needed to be bigger.
Yeah.
And I started writing, and it sort of became a book. And yes, I think it is. It is, because there's a part of me that identifies with Roisin. I mean, I'm not, that is not me, but there are elements of me in that, certainly when she's a child and she's a little bit feral. I share those experiences, but
yeah,
it's not me. But yes, it was cathartic, I think, and I was very pleased when I finished it, because it did feel as though I'd put the last dot to something that had been hovering around for an awful long time.
Yeah. Well, well done you for getting it all down, getting it out there. If people want to get a copy, it's called The Sea Glass Beach. It's available on our website, tre.radio, and it's by Tina Pritchard, who we've been chatting with today. Tina, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Hannah.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
The TRE Book Show is sponsored by audible.co.uk. Download one title each month, plus unlimited listening to thousands of Audible originals, podcasts and audiobooks. Just click on the Audible banner at www.tre.radio.
You've been listening to a TRE production. If you've enjoyed this programme, there'll be another episode waiting for you next week, right here on this platform, where you can also access our extensive back catalogue of shows and interviews. For more information on our live programming, social media channels and apps, and how to contact Talk Radio Europe, please visit tre.radio.